Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm going to waste no time reminding my panel that I thought this title race was still on, even with an 8-point gap. Because yes, because I am a savant. So who is that panel this week? Well, it's Stuart Robson, Rory K. Smith, and of course, Matt Dickinson. Later on, we'll be looking at Team GB and the Olympic football team. But let's start at Old Trafford. All right, Manchester United and Everton. I thought this was a very unusual game with sort of lots of ebbs and flows and lots of very good goals. But Stuart, I'm still left with the fact that United conceded four goals at home to an Everton team that, you know, was coming off a very disappointing FA Cup semi-final. How does that happen?
Well, I give credit to David Moyes, because everyone expected Everton to go there and play with one up front, five in midfield, and play on the counter-attack. They didn't do that. Right from the first whistle, they pressed Manchester United. They didn't let De Gea throw it out to the back players, and Manchester United didn't know how to cope for a while. And there was great movement from Jelovic. Fellaini played as a second centre-forward. I thought he was absolutely outstanding. And Pienaar kept on rotating his position from central midfield into wide areas, and all three of those players were a creative force for Everton.
And despite no Leighton Baines, what, the other seven guys kind of
actually Distan got forward as well from left back. Osman tucked in and made good runs. The two midfield players passed negatively, Neville and Gibson, but those four in front of them I thought played exceptionally well.
Dicko, does that pretty much photograph it for you? Is it that simple?
Well, no, I mean, I think praise to Everton, as Stuart says, but I mean, the more I look at those the last two goals that Everton scored, the more I'm just dumbfounded by how static the not just United defence, but the midfield is. I mean, you look at Everton there, they're sitting deep. I mean, they're almost on their own penalty spot. And B, there is not a single player even attempting to close someone down. I mean, it's almost like a training ground exercise, both goals, where you just see Everton players passing between each other, no attempt to snap at them, to close them down, to harass. I mean, it's laughable defending, not just from the defence, but from the midfield too. You see Scholes and Carrick are pretty much just sort of stood there on the 18-yard line, sort of, you know, challenging Everton to pass around them, which they duly do.
Roy, I want to get to you. You're not honest here, I want to get to you in a minute, but since we're picking on individual mistakes by veteran professional footballers, let's turn to the professional footballer among us. Stuart, what goes through, help me understand, right? Because this is Paul Scholes, it's Rio Ferdinand, it's Michael Carrick, it's Johnny Evans. These guys are people who, you know, beyond the obviously have paid a lot of money and so on, and were also on a good run and had plenty of reason to be confident and they're playing for something. How do they all just kind of switch off at once? With Fellaini's volley, it looked like the guy was like 3 yards away from him. How does that happen with a veteran player who's actually on a good run?
Well, I think they when they were 4-2 up, when they were 3-1 up, they thought the game was won. And when you look at Scholes and Carrick, both are exceptional passers of the ball, but both lack athleticism. They both lack defensive qualities. And I was really disappointed with Ferdinand yesterday. He took up some terrible positions. Sometimes he went to close down in midfield and the ball was played behind
him. How does that happen, though? I mean, because we're not talking...
I wonder how much defensive work, and I see it throughout the Premier League, how much defensive work is now being done by coaches? Because they want to keep the players happy these days, managers and coaches, and they do a lot of technical play, they do a lot of five-a-sides, small-sided games, let the players play. But I don't see good defensive coaching these. I don't see good defensive strategies. You don't... I mean, when Ferdinand made a couple of decisions in the first half and Johnny Evans backed off, there was great big spaces for Jelovic to run into. And when I look at that, there is no basic strategy coming from the defensive coaches at the moment.
Rory, you're nodding. I'm assuming you agree.
I am, although I've got to say the one player that I'd have picked on particularly, don't like picking on individuals, Raphael for the fourth goal.
Picked on the foreign guy, see?
The ball watching is incredible.
And the first.
But the fourth one, it's 4-3. You've got 5 minutes to hold on, get a win that, you know, pretty much leaves the title in your own hands. Fellaini's difficult to take the ball off, can understand that he can hold off, which I think it might have been Ferdinand, the central defender. Understand that, fine, big lad. Raphael just watches Stephen Pienaar walk, not sprint, walk, maybe slightly jog, to the edge of the six-yard box and doesn't track him, which is, I mean, it's unforgivable.
We don't just want to pick on United's defensive mistakes, also because they had, I mean, I think they've kept clean sheets in 6 of their 7 previous games, something like that. And while I was a source to say, like, guys, don't get too excited. They look that good to me against, you know, against Fulham and against Blackburn and so on. Defensively, at least, it looked as if, you know, Evans and Ferdinand, much maligned perhaps by some early in the season, were doing the job.
But you can spin the figures however you want, because this has still been the season now that United have conceded the most goals at Old Trafford in the Premier League and all through the season.
What a lot of the top clubs do, when they believe that their possession play is so good and they keep the ball and they play the opposition, make them defend deeply, so the opposition have to counter-attack and can't counter-attack with enough pace. You know, I see it at Arsenal, I see it at Chelsea, I see it at the top clubs. When you get good possession, your defensive responsibilities aren't highlighted quite so much. Yesterday, Everton put pressure on Manchester United, and Manchester United couldn't cope, and they made poor decisions. Ferdinand made poor decisions. Evans made poor decisions, when to back off, when to come forward. Raphael at right back went to sleep on too many occasions when the ball got played past him, didn't recover. He just looked out of sorts on the day.
And it leaves Fergie with, I mean, fascinating decisions to make to go to Man City, you know, where, as Stuart says, they're going to come under, you know, not just the same pressure as Everton, but far more. And I mean, it's, you know, even if Mancini you know, doesn't pick his most attacking team, so it's going to, I mean, it's tough for Ferguson, because, you know, it's very hard for him to put any kind of midfield that screens the defence, because he just doesn't have that sort of player available. So, I mean, it's Fergie's team is going to be a fascination.
Dicko, amongst all the negativity and Fergie problems, should we celebrate what were some exceptional goals, I thought, in this game? I'm thinking of Welbeck, took that strike extremely well. There's a very nice, almost poetic description of it by our colleague Ollie Kay in the game today, and also Rooney's goal with a 1-2, and of course, I guess Fellaini's strike was a nice strike, but the other guy was also standing like 5 yards off him, and I always kind of feel like, you know what, if you're a professional footballer, you do this for a living, you really should be nailing that every single time. But the fact that these were very good goals, does this somehow like distort the fact that we don't expect to see so many good goals in a game, so it's really not a 4-4, so it really would have been maybe like a 2-2, something like that, and so we're more prone to criticize United, or am I grasping at straws here to defend Sir Alex?
No, I mean, you know, it's sort of, you can just divorce the two. I mean the fact is some wonderful attacking play, and you know, it's great to see Welbeck in decent form. I think he's going to play for England this summer, and you know, not necessarily because he's, you know, ready or outstanding, but he's the best we've got, and particularly you know, given the way that the team's going to have to be set up. But you know, I think there was some very, very shoddy defending and some excellent attack. Attacking play, and the combinations between Rooney and Welbeck, say with an England hat on, were particularly encouraging.
I think what Everton have shown, and Wigan to an extent at the DW and Blackburn at Old Trafford, if you go to the big sides now, if you go to Arsenal, Chelsea, City, United, and you try to attack, you get something. They're all vulnerable. None of them are as high quality as they were.
What Everton did yesterday, they surprised Manchester United, not just with their attacking play, but right from the start of the game, they said, we're going to pin you back. We're not going to let you have easy possession. We're not going to let De Gea throw it out to Ferdinand, and we're not going to drop off to the halfway. We're going to press you high up the field. What are you going to do about it? And Manchester United didn't know what to do about it. You have to play beyond the pressure and get it into the front place. Then Fellaini, I think, well, it's no good me pressing there because I keep being bypassed. It's no good the midfield pressing high because they get bypassed. So then they drop off, and then you've got space to play. Manchester United didn't do that. They played into Everton's hands.
But then the reason they would have been surprised is because Everton never do that at United. Everton, under Moyes, have always gone for safety first, try and hold out, and they normally lose 1-0. And obviously he worked out this time, and credit to Moyes, who isn't always the most decisive manager.
They're a much better side, Everton, as well, when they do that. I've seen them come to Arsenal and play against Arsenal. When they press the ball, they give Arsenal a good game. When they drop off and let Arsenal play, they get humiliated at times.
All right, let's try to do a little crystal ball thing, which leads to humiliation about the run-in with United and City. So we're all taking it as read that City beat United. If City beat United on Monday, then we've got a run-in of two games.
Yeah.
United have Swansea at home and Sunderland away. City have Newcastle away and QPR at home. Dicko, scenarios?
I still have to favour United. Just
easier running, right?
Yeah, well, slightly that, and you know, I mean, ultimately they can, you know, they can afford a draw at next Monday night, can't they? So you know, it's.
Assuming City beat United. I think
That's a big assumption, though, isn't
right.
it?
I mean, but we're all assuming that United are going to win the title. I mean, if United,
I just think that you know the run-ins, you know, it looks like, you know, especially just simply down to the fact that City have got to go to Newcastle, that gives them, you know, on paper the harder run-in. But I think if I'm asking you for any prediction, I just look at Monday and think, well, if one team can afford a draw, then that has to make them narrow favourites, even if the game's at City.
Hey, Stuart, one thing when we look at this, when we look at the run-ins and we decide sort of what's tougher, playing Swansea and Sunderland, we always sort of, I think, imagine two things. We imagine whether the team has something to play for, and obviously in City's case, both Newcastle and QPR, if they're not relegated or safe by that point, which they probably won't be, you know, both will have a lot to play for. And we look at whether there's some extra motivation there on the part of the manager. And Brendan Rodgers and Martin O'Neill at this stage of the season seem rather milquetoast compared to somebody like Mark Hughes, who's got plenty of reasons to go and try to mess Manchester City up, as well as obviously keep his own job and do well for QPR. Does that play into it at all, do you think? I mean, do managers with extra motivation, does that filter down to the players? Or is that just a silly media narrative that we make up?
I think so, because Sir Alex Ferguson will cast you back to the game where West Ham had already been relegated many seasons ago, and they played Manchester United, I think, on the last day of the season. And West Ham came out and played brilliantly and beat Manchester United, or certainly might have even got a draw. And Sir Alex Ferguson said their effort and attitude was disgusting because they'd been relegated by, you know, 6 or 7 points, but still put in a magnificent display on the last day of the season to get something out of Manchester United. I think it put the title to Blackburn, I think, on that occasion. So at home, when you're playing at home, it doesn't matter whether you haven't got anything to play for. When you're playing in front of your own fans, you have to play, and Sunderland will have to play. They will have to put a lot of heart and soul into that game, and they will play with passion against Manchester United.
I was at Fulham Wigan on Saturday, the game this weekend that everyone's talking about, and Martin Yol referred to the fact that he's kept his players motivated despite the fact that Fulham are basically fighting to finish either 9th or 11th as the trick of the wizard, which is quite a nice turn of phrase and slightly self-aggrandising, which appeals to me. And I think, to be fair to Brendan Rodgers and Martin O'Neill, they're both capable of pulling off that trick. Rodgers has kept Swansea going. They've had peaks and troughs, as you'd expect, but they're easily safe, they're mid-table, but they're still, you know, they're still doing the right things, and Martin O'Neill's side's never ever let up.
Well, guess what? Not much of a Southern bias this week, because having been to Old Trafford, we're going to go to Newcastle, where it's United and Stoke. And I kind of feel like this season except when we've had George Culkin on, we've been sort of praising Newcastle without fully really getting how they're top four in the table. Because let's all be honest, I don't know, out of all of us, does anybody here really rate Alan Pardew before he took over and think that he was a good manager who was going to do wonders with Chris Hughton? I certainly didn't. I thought the team was going to go downhill because Chris Hughton is good and he's a good person, and Alan Pardew.
I can say my one claim I can make here is that when I thought a lot of the I guess because people liked Hughton and the decision sort of came out of the blue, there was an awful lot of wailing at the time that this was a good man badly treated. But I mean, I did think it was an upgrade. I'm not going to go further than that and say I have it a rag out that Newcastle would finish fourth in the title. But I thought it was potentially an upgrade, and I think say people were reacting more to the fact that they thought Mike Ashley was some grubby brutish owner and Chris Hughton was a nice guy than necessarily to whether the decision was the right one or the wrong one.
But Dicko, what struck me about it was they had that great start and I thought, all right, they're obviously going to tail off here or revert to the mean. But then it seems that, Ben Arfa getting consistent playing time after his injury, getting back to his best, coupled with Papiss Cissé coming in January, all of a sudden just gave them this new unexpected boost. And there they are, and they're in serious danger of finishing.
Well, I think we all expected them to tail off at a certain point, but you've named the player. I mean, since they got, is it 11 goals now since January, which, it's a tally you'd be pretty, acceptable for the season. He's done it since January. So just when we thought that they might run out of steam, they've actually come up with, fresh players playing absolutely exceptionally, fitting in with the system and giving them a fresh boost. And to be honest, all of us who've kept saying, surely they won't, are suddenly looking at the table thinking, well, maybe they might.
I think as much credit as Newcastle deserve, and it's a huge amount of credit for the way the club's been run, which you never thought you'd say about Mike Ashley, the scouting system, the way they're playing. The other thing is that everyone else who should have been in contention for fourth have been horribly inconsistent. I mean,
you're saying everyone else as if Newcastle should have been one of those ties sides contending for fourth.
No, they shouldn't, but you get to sort of November and they'd had a good start, and as you say, we all expected them to tail off. I think in a web chat I ruled them out of finishing fourth because it wasn't worth discussing whether they would, which I now regret somewhat. But you would have thought that one of Arsenal, Chelsea, Spurs, or even Liverpool would have kicked on and got a great... I mean, I don't know what the points tally will be this season, but I suspect it's not going to be very high to finish fourth. If Spurs don't collapse, Newcastle don't finish fourth.
But I saw them live at Stoke on Saturday, and for the first 15 minutes, I was thinking to myself, what is their game plan? I couldn't see what their game plan was. They were playing balls into the front that weren't particularly good, and they were dropping off deep and trying to play into midfield, and that wasn't quite working. Then they scored the goal. The crowd suddenly get behind them, and then you see the quality of their players. And the thing about Bar and Cissé, what they do is they look to get turned. They give the ball away cheaply at times, but whenever it comes into their feet, they're looking to get turned to play the next ball forward. They're looking to get turned to run down the sides of defenders. And in Kabay, playing behind the main striker, he was absolutely sensational in terms of his passing, in terms of his vision, in terms of the timing of his runs when he got forward. And he had the perfect foil in Tiote, who gets on the ball off the back players, and he'd play little 1-2s around pressure and switch the play. I thought they were outstanding for a good hour. They didn't play very well in the first 15 minutes. They went off the boil in the last 15 minutes. But that 60 minutes, they were absolutely outstanding.
Yeah,
and on Rory's point, I mean, they are going to get, I mean, 60, Arsenal had 68-ish points last season. And they're going to, they're on course for that. So I agree. I mean, I agree with Rory that, it is a measure of Tottenham's collapse, Arsenal's, early season woes, etc. But it's, they're doing it on their own merits.
Oh, yeah, and I don't want to diminish their achievement at all. And the other thing that this will appeal to Gab's sort of desire to create some sort of Italian-style north-south divide in England, the number of southern managers who've gone...
Because I've created it, and it was never there before.
You're trying to make it, you're trying to politicise it, Gab. We can all see your agenda. The number of southern managers who've gone to the big industrial northern clubs and succeeded are very, very low. And that's a measure of Pardew's achievement, but that he's gone to a completely different culture and achieved what he's done this season.
You're making it seem as if he's moved to Mongolia or something.
No, there's a massive cultural difference. If you can name me another southern manager who's done well at a big northern club, who's not Harry Bassett.
I don't know. You guys all seem foreign in English to me. I don't generally distinguish between north and south the way you do. But by the way, if people out there, if you want to hit us up on Twitter with names of southern managers who've done well up north, please do. And our resident Yorkshireman here will will no doubt be thankful. I just want to go back a second to Yohan Cabaye here because, I follow European football. I knew who the guy was, and he was playing for Lille. And he actually changed his position. He was playing deeper for Lille this last season, but he played in a more attacking role and scored a fair few goals. And I thought, wow, he's a technically gifted player. He's got a bit of an edge because he played in a deeper position last year. You can get him for $5.25 million, something like that, because it was a buyout clause. Yeah, why not? It was probably a good signing. I didn't expect that he would be this good, but it seemed like a bit of a no-brainer. He's playing for the French champions, for goodness sakes. And I think this season he's been those passes. When we talked about this yesterday, Stuart. Well, if this guy were English or playing for a club other than Newcastle, would he have been in the Player of the Year contention?
I'm sure he would have been because as a midfield player, he seems to have everything. He's competitive. You know, get his foot in. He chased around. He was the first one to close people down on Saturday as well against Stoke when they were playing with one up front and Barr went into a wide area and they had two centre halves, obviously Stoke and the spare player. It was Cabaye who ran from midfield to go and close one of the centre halves. Then so he showed that he's got a determined side. And then when he had the ball, the pass that he produced for Cissé's goal was magnificent because he's looking at the pass. It looked as though a switch of play was on, and suddenly he sees Cissé out the corner of his eye just make the little run. I've watched it again and again to see who made the first initial move. Was it the pass or was it the run? It was slightly the run, but to change his mind right at the last minute to play that pass was absolutely and to wait it perfectly. It was outstanding.
Dicko, what's your view on this? Well, why is Cabaye at $5.25 million a risk, and Craig Gardner? I'm not picking on him. Either at 5.5 or 6 or whatever much he cost, he's not a risk.
Well, I guess if in terms of bringing a player over from abroad all that way from an hour train ride an hour train ride under a bit of sea. Sometimes it can take even the very best players. I mean, I'd say I still have my all-time cautionary tale is Robert Pirès, who I remember slating week after week.
If I jump in here, we're all really atoning today between your admission that you thought Pirès was rubbish and Rory saying that he had no faith in Newcastle's ability to finish top four. Saying Pardew was going to be any good.
It's the hair shirt flog yourself edition.
Exactly. Stuart, you're going to have to come up with something.
I called Alan Pardew when he got the job. Somebody asked me, do I think he's a good man? I said, I think he's a bit of a fraud, was my quote.
That's right, yeah. But you just hate him because he messed up West Ham when he was there. Sorry, Dicko, proceed.
So where were we? But no, sometimes, of course there's an element of risk. Because I say, if someone as classy as Pirès, who went on to become Football of the Year, can just look completely at sea, just look, I guess he looked fragile with the pace league, and that should never have been a risk with Cabaye. But to come to the French champions at that price certainly doesn't look to be an outlandish risk. But Newcastle, £5 million for them in their transfer budget is quite a lot of money, but very shrewdly spent.
I saw Cabaye for Lille when they played Liverpool in the Europa League in 2010. I would imagine. And he, along with Florent Balmont and is it Obraniak, the left winger?
Ludovic Obraniak
looked very good. Gervinho was in that team. Eden Hazard, Debussy, you could tell they're a good side. You could tell Cabaye was a good player. But I think the risk element is that you had no idea that he would be as good in England as consistently as he is, especially because in France there's a sort of theory that he bottles it a little bit in big games.
But the biggest thing.
But can we put my England hat back on? Scotty.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Parker's going to sort him out in the Euros.
Absolutely. With his power haircut.
But the biggest thing about Newcastle has been the fact they got rid of the players they needed to get rid of. Barton was a bad influence. They say he's a big character. He was a bad influence. Nolan had too much to say in the dressing room and didn't allow the managers probably to do what they wanted to do. And Carroll meant they had to play a certain way and was causing problems with other players, having fights with other players. So by getting rid of those three players, Newcastle suddenly had a newfound team spirit.
And yet, conventional wisdom states that Kevin Nolan and Joey Barton are exactly the sorts of players you need in the Premier League, as they're proven Premier League players, when in fact they're just a study in mediocrity. And what Newcastle have done is they've identified people who are big characters, who are big names in England, but actually aren't that good at football, and they've replaced them with players who are a lot quieter, who are much better at football, and that is ultimately what matters.
I don't want to slight our friends in Stoke, especially since our producer Chris Skinner, despite being more of an Essex man himself, he's got relatives who are from Stoke. So Stuart, you saw the game. At this stage of the season, if you're Tony Pulis, if you've got these players, you're going to end up in a respectable finish again this year. What kind of stuff are you looking for in the last sort of 4 to 6 games of the season? You're not going to go down. You're not going to get into Europe. Are you starting to test things for next season? What's he doing?
I've watched Tony Pulis's teams for the time they've been in the Premier League. Now, when they're at home, they play. When they're away, they play a direct style of football. But for direct style of football to work, you have to have players around the knockdowns. So if you go from back to front, you have to have midfield players. You have to have wide players. You have to have a second striker who's making forward runs. And then from the knockdowns, you then start to play, get it out wide and get crosses into the box. When they play away from home, by playing Peter Crouch up front by himself, and Walters does try and make runs to get close to him, but when he's got Shotton on the right hand side, who's really a right back playing as a right winger, and Etherington hardly getting a touch of the ball, they were outplayed in midfield. There was 3-2 in midfield, so they weren't going to gain control there. So when they do win the ball back in their own half and they play it up to Peter Crouch, he's had an impossible job to try and keep hold of it. At some point, Tony Pulis has got to come up with a game plan that is as good away from home as it is at home, and it means they've got to play higher up. They've got to play with the same intensity higher up the field.
Stoke are in quite an interesting position, though, and it's something that you sort of look at for the last 2 or 3 years, that will there come a point where what they do, and they do very well normally at home, which will get them sort of 11th or 12th every year, not without too much trouble.
But you'll see a lot of effort next week will be their biggest effort, because Pulis hates Wenger with a passion and he will do everything he possibly can to beat Arsenal, I'm telling you.
Stay tuned for next week, then. All right, this week in our debate, we're going to be talking about the Olympic team. It includes, on the short list of 80 names, it includes people like Chris Brunt, who I believe is from Northern Ireland, which is not part of Great Britain. It's part of the United Kingdom. But anyway, maybe Team UK is not as markable a term. But I want to get a sense from you because there's so much negativity from those in the football establishment towards Olympic football, especially in this country. I'm sure at some point Rory K. Smith will tell us about how in South America they love Olympic football. And I, for one, can tell you how they love Olympic football in Africa. Here, it's just not the same thing. And on top of that is the fact that y'all haven't had an Olympic team for a long time until this time around. Most normal countries, the under 23, or at least the European ones, the under 21 team is your Olympic team, essentially. It's been like that for the last three or four Olympics. Dicko, what's the purpose of Olympic football? Can something good come out of it for...
Maybe for other countries, it's an entertainment business for us this summer as a one-off to throw some players together and pick David Beckham and have a bit of fun. I mean, we're not going to win it, and we're not going to enter it again. So it's a complete one-off. There's this sort of obligation on us as hosts and a chance for us as hosts to play in it, and we're going to treat it as a bit of a joke, and then we won't do it again. People are getting very worked up about Beckham should be in it or not. I mean, to be honest, because of where we're at and because it's this one-off and because I'll be taking my kids, I actually think, oh, great, I'm quite looking forward to taking my kids to see David Beckham have a last hurrah because I'm not taking it very seriously. But... say that's because we're in this rather unique situation where it's a complete one-off. We're not rehearsing for this tournament. We're throwing a Welsh player and a Scots player and a Northern Irish player in there to sort of make it feel like it's GB, whereas other nations will take it seriously and good luck to them.
Correction, you're throwing the Northern Ireland player in there to make it feel like it's UK, not GB. And I wish at some point somebody would explain it to Seb Coe and the rest of those types. Dicko lineup, I think, explained the way it is. Is that the way it should be?
No, not at all, because you see so many Olympians, they have to train to their maximum, they have to fight to get into the Olympic team. Now we're saying that the Olympic football tournament is a bit of a joke and a good bit of fun, and then we can let David Beckham have a last hurrah. He shouldn't be anywhere near the squad.
Well, the rules do call for three overage.
Yeah, but there must be better over 23-year-olds that are more that will give something more than David Beckham rather than just filling the stadium. Because, how do other athletes feel there was people that ran the marathon yesterday to try and qualify to get into the Olympics, into the Olympic team, and just failed. How do they feel that the UK team, or the GB football team, are taking it as a bit of a joke?
Yeah, the interview with Lee, was it Lee Merrion, the marathon runner who finished 17th at the London Marathon, which is a lot better than our producer Chris, and just outside the qualifying time, the interview with him was absolutely heartbreaking. It really was, worse than watching Terry Connor.
Why?
Much. Just because he'd worked so hard and trained so hard and come so close and failed. Come on, Dab, have a heart. And
I actually, people try very hard and work very hard at many different things all the time to do with their livelihood, actually. This guy is an amateur, right? So he trained very hard, got some sponsors to pay for him to train to go to the Olympics. Oh, look, he didn't make the qualifying time. Why? Because something conspired against him? No, because there were enough other people who were better than him. I honestly don't feel sorry
exactly.
for your friend.
Exactly, but there's other
people
that are better than David
exactly.
Beckham that should be in the football team.
But the thing is, the fact is that FIFA and the IOC have got to take some blame this as well. I mean, it's a contrived tournament. I mean, no doubt someone will try and... I've read pieces sort of convincing me that it's, integral to...
Sorry, why is it a contrived tournament when it's older than the World Cup and the European Championship?
Because the establishment of three over age... But, I mean, what sort of tournament do you have where you have, under 23s plus you had three?
I've studied this at length, not to sound all professorial here, and I know you know, but just for those who don't know, maybe I should take a little detour and explain how we got to this situation. So originally, in the dawn of time when the first Olympic tournaments started up, they didn't really make a distinction between amateurs and professionals. They kind of assumed that everybody was amateur and professional was just a way to keep certain people who got paid out of the Olympics, and tragic stories like Jim Thorpe and so on, which I'm sure everybody's familiar with. once they made that, once they started policing this more closely, in really with the 52 Olympics in
Finland,
Helsinki, yeah. That's when they started making a distinction between amateur sides and professionals, and that's when teams started having a problem of who they would send, and everybody kind of made their own. First, they started actually sending amateurs. Teams in Eastern Europe, of course, just kept sending their national sides because they said, "Oh, look, we're all out of amateurs here in the Soviet Union," and so they started outperforming a lot of others. Eventually, they kept reaching certain compromise solutions. For a long time, as you could send any player who hadn't been capped for the national team, but he might be a professional. Until eventually, we reached this situation where FIFA wanted it to be an under 23 tournament. The IOC said, "No, you got to give us some guys because this is really it's a really big tournament, especially to nations in Africa and South America." And so we've reached a situation where you can have three overage players. Three overage players, you would think, and in some cases this is the case. Well, we get our three best senior internationals. Now it's turned into, we want to reward this guy, and this guy brings publicity, and so on. Well, that's how we got there, Dicko, basically.
Yeah, it is.
That's what you have a problem with.
It's just a bizarre. I mean, I think it's more of a sort of, you're right, explaining how we got there, but I think it's just a fudge between an IOC that wants some stardust on the tournament and the overage players give them a chance at that, and FIFA, who don't want it to clash directly with a World Cup or an under-21 championship. So it's a contrived fudge, which doesn't, who wants to be part of a tournament that's a contrived fudge? I have a problem with, football being in the Olympics at all. I have a problem with the format.
Why do you have a problem with football being in the Olympics at all?
Well, because it's, as we've touched on a bit there about the marathon runner, but I mean, I think the Olympics should be the pinnacle of any sport, and I just, the Olympics has got bloated, and I don't think football should be part of it. I think it should be, golf shouldn't be there, football shouldn't be there, tennis shouldn't be there, there's all sorts of sports shouldn't be there.
It's
not about proving the best in the world. So what on, you are proving the best under 23 player plus a under 23 team plus a few others.
I can see your argument for football in the current format, not being there, if you think, because it is a bit of a fudge. But let's say we were to move the Euros to an odd numbered year, or there was some other solution whereby the Olympic tournament people could send their senior sides if
they
qualified.
But they can't at the moment. Just,
if they could, would you still have a problem? Would you still sort of blanket say these sports like tennis, football should not be in the Olympics?
I still think I went to some of the Olympic football in Beijing. It didn't do it for me. It didn't feel fans turn up.
But why?
Fans turn up for anything. It is not what I associate with the Olympics. It's not what I feel the Olympics is about, because it is not, and never will be, because the calendar will never work, about proving who is the best football team out there. It's about proving who is the best, team that someone can cobble together for a tournament that doesn't seem to be proving a point at all.
I agree with Dicko generally. I think that tennis, golf, football, any sport where the pinnacle arrives outside of the Olympics shouldn't be in the Olympics, because it detracts from the achievements of others. That said, I think the way that Team GB are approaching it is abominable. I really do. I think the tokenism, not just of chucking in, one Northern Irish fella, one Scottish fella, although I would suggest that Stephen Fletcher will prove himself to be the greatest striker in the world on this stage this summer, is stupid. The fact that Beckham's even under consideration is an absolute joke. Just because it shouldn't be there doesn't mean it isn't, obviously, and we might as well take it relatively seriously. Does it something to be fair that you'd have thought?
Well, the problem is it's going to be a somewhat of a GB team. Every other nation, Argentina see it as one of their big development tournaments. I mean, they're not in it this time, but Brazil see it as one of their big development. They play under 17 World Cup, they play under 20 World Cup, and then the next one for them is the Olympic tournament.
Or the pre-Olympic, as they call it.
Yeah, the Olympic tournament, and then the World Cup. They see it as a massive part of their development. But because we haven't got an English team, we can't use it as a development.
Well, if you look at the way the Uruguayans are, not to bring it back to South America, predictably, Dad, but the way the Uruguayans are approaching it, Godin wants to go, Lugano wants to go, Suarez wants to go, they want to play in this tournament. They will send their under-23 side, which I think is pretty special anyway, and probably their three best senior international.
But given that, you know, you accept that we're sort of doing a politically correct team by sticking a Scotsman, a Welshman, whatever in there, I mean, why don't we just go whole hog and put Beckham in there and if we're going to be contrived about the rest of it, then what's the offence with putting Beckham in as well?
Well, I don't think it has to be that contrived. Gareth Bale would be in there anyway. Fletcher, to be honest, and a lot of people won't agree with me, there's an argument that Fletcher might have a chance of getting in there because he's not a bad striker. The Northern Irish may be slightly more of a problem, but it's not that much tokenism to send out your strongest team. It's not. It's not beyond the realms of possibility.
Would you feel better about this if England wasn't in, or this country wasn't in, this sort of strange situation where it's four nations and four FAs but one actual physical country, and you've got all this sort of confusion about it? Would it be easier for you to wrap your heads around?
Much easier if it was an English side going into it.
No, not an English side. But what if we got rid of the other FAs and you actually all became one country the way a lot of people within FIFA would want you to be? Do you be less unruly?
What? It's never going to happen, though, is it?
Says who?
Alex Salmond.
Alex, yes, I was going to say.
But, I mean, Dicko, we've been through this. I mean, at some point, for us who aren't, you know, aren't blessed with aren't British, it's difficult for us to understand how you can be one and four at the same time and still want that when it comes to sport.
Well, it's not. As Roy alludes to with Alex Salmond. I mean, things might be heading the other direction. Never mind, conjoining us. But there's separate leagues, separate associations for decades and centuries. Just because a few guys at FIFA would like to sort of get rid of our historical rights, and maybe we should surrender those historical rights. But to be honest, all they do is wind everyone up, and all we get to do is have no influence about, bringing in, whether we can bring in extra officials or not, or change the rules on snoods at IFAB. We get all the association with being a bunch of stuck-up people who sort of think we have a historical right to run the game and no power out of it.
I think that's about as eloquent as anyone could have put it on this St. George's Day. All right, time now for some quick hits. Chelsea's B team, all told, got the job done at the Emirates, and none other than Arsene Wenger says they can humble Barca. Rory, was it the right strategic decision to rest so many guys ahead of the Champions League? And is the £750,000 bonus Roman Abramovich is offering Di Matteo if he wins the Champions League somewhat cheap and chintzy given the magnitude of the achievement?
I don't think it is, given that if he wins the Champions League, he'll also presumably have to pay him £3 or £4 million a year to be his full-time manager.
You could sack him if you wanted to.
If they win the Champions League, surely even Abramovich can't sack him, although I haven't said that, you never know. Was it the right decision? I think it was, although it's a massive risk, and it was a lose-lose situation. Chelsea aren't a young side. They'll need fresh legs to cover the wide open spaces of the Nou Camp, which are 6 metres less long and 5 metres less wide than the wide open spaces of the Emirates. But I think he didn't really have a choice.
Is it really that much, or did you just make those numbers up?
No, the Emirates, I think, is 6 metres longer than the Nou Camp and 5 metres thinner, I think. It's a much, much bigger pitch. Much bigger pitch.
Because they say the Nou Camp is only 1 metre wider than Chelsea's ground and 2 metres longer,
yeah,
I think.
The problem with that is that you can spin the fitters how you want. That's 220 square metres, which sounds a lot more than 1 metre longer, 2 metres wider. But the Emirates
not really. It's just like a giant L-shaped slice at the edge of the pitch. It's not really. Like,
It's 10 metres squared per person, which is the size of the average bedroom.
6 points out of a possible 27 for Harry Redknapp's Spurs after the defeat at QPR. Stuart, you're entirely impartial of this one, too. How much of the blame goes to Harry Redknapp? And if the FA had a shortlist, which I'm sure they don't since they've told us that they don't, should they be reconsidering Redknapp's position on the list?
No, I don't think they should be reconsidering it. As you said, I'm not sure he's on the shortlist, but I'm told that he doesn't do too much coaching. I'm told that hasn't got great tactical acumen. It's a bit of a worry when your head coach is going to be somebody like that. He took a lot of praise for how they did in the early part of the season, and that was probably over the top, and he's taken a lot of criticism for how they've played recently.
Has he taken a lot of criticism?
I think he did in recent times, he has. I think the real problem for Tottenham, they lost confidence at about 20 past whatever the time. It was 4:20 on a Sunday afternoon when they were 2-0 up against Arsenal, and suddenly Arsenal came back into the game, having been so good defensively, suddenly they concede 5 goals. From that moment on, they've been a different side. And if you haven't got a centre forward who works hard, like Addie Boyer doesn't work hard week in, week out, and Defoe doesn't work hard week in, week out, and Van der Vaart doesn't work hard enough to defend when they haven't got the ball, you're going to have a problem.
Gabriele, one for you. Real Madrid win 2-1 at Barcelona and all but lock up the Spanish title. Your thoughts, and since he was there, unlike you, let's get Dicko's as well.
I haven't owned a television, I'll have you know. I think in some ways Mourinho got the monkey off his back with this one. It was 10 attempts to beat Barcelona before this, and if you discount the one that came in extra time, it was 0 wins, 5 draws, and 5 defeats. That's not good. But Real Madrid actually just played their own game, and it was left to Pep Guardiola to make all the adjustments and tinker with the formation and leave out Piqué and Alexis Sanchez and Cesc Fabregas and maybe overthink this one a little bit. And Real Madrid punished them.
No, I agree. I thought, even 5-10 minutes in, I just were dumbfounded really a bit by the setup, midfield setup of Barcelona. It's this sort of bizarre box shape with Thiago and Busquets deep, and it basically pushed Xavi and Iniesta forward, so that they were basically sort of parked right next to Kadira and Alonso, and it absolutely lost all their usual fluidity. Lots of, you know, Tello way out wide left, isolated, Messi isolated, and the empire's hardly crumbling. But that's 2 defeats in a row for the first time in 3 years, and just a sliver of doubt.
It was Teo's third ever league start for Barcelona. I just wonder how many managers in the world would have the intestinal fortitude to go and start somebody in their third ever game against their biggest rival in a match that could decide the title.
Yeah, the issue with Barcelona, the broader issue, I think, is, and Dicko, as he's just outlined there, his tactical breakdown of what's wrong with Barcelona in the paper today is absolutely superb. But the issue with Guardiola is, has he let the philosophy dominate the pragmatism? Their squad is paper thin apart from the youth team products, Martin Montoya, Teo, Cuenca, and all of whom look very, very raw. You do wonder whether maybe they're a couple of players short. I don't think that it's fair to say that they're finished or that they're not, you know, that the magic's rubbed off or anything like that. But a couple of extra senior players in the summer would have made a huge difference, as would a fully fit David Villa.
Well, I think Villa is crucial. I mean, the finishing, as we've seen, it's hardly lacked goals this season, but the last two games at critical times, the finishing's been poor, and it's been poor, and you really could see, you know, Villa, you would have put your money on Villa scoring the chances that Teo missed on Saturday and Fabregas missed at Stamford Bridge.
Okay, so I note that you're spending all this time poking holes and saying what was wrong with Barcelona rather than celebrating Real Madrid. Stuart,
and I'm
going to give you
thrilled for Jersey.
This is extremely upsetting to certain people. Stuart, you have a chance to set this right.
Well, Mourinho is still the best coach in the world. He's the best tactical coach in the world. He's one of the coaches that goes out on the training field and works day in, day out. And he concentrates on when the ball changes hands. That is key to any sort of winning formula. When the ball changes hands, you have to either attack very quickly or you have to defend very quickly. And Real Madrid did that against Barcelona. They stopped Barcelona playing, and they also looked threatening on the counter.
Well done, Real Madrid. You're on your way to your 32nd title. That's all we've got time for this week. But before I let you go, please hear me out, because I'm going to say something different at the end of this podcast. Yes, I'm going to be telling you that we're going to be doing another live roadshow with me and also some very, very special TBD guests. It's going to be at the Freemasons Arm, which is, Skinner, what is that? Is that some kind of a pub or drinking establishment?
It sells booze.
What about, there's some people who don't
sell soft drinks.
Okay. All right, you can get an alcoholic beverage, you can get a non-alcoholic beverages. That's right near Covent Garden in central London. It's going to be on May 29th from around 7 p.m. And you can book your tickets at www.timestickets.co.uk. Yes, that's timestickets.co.uk. That's rather intuitive. Or you can also call 0871-620-4025. The event will only set you back £7.50 ahead. But those of us who came to our last event will hopefully be able to confirm that it is value for money. In the meantime, of course, you can go to thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis. You can follow all of us on Twitter, except for Stuart Robson, the man trapped in 2004. Till next week. Bye-bye.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.